Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and what are you doing? You listen to me? You listen to me? You listen to me? Then who the hell else are you listening to? You listening to me? Well, I'm the only one here. Who the f*** do you think you're listening to? Sorry, what I meant to say was, hi! It's issue 162 of the Bugle, the last remaining untainted pillar of Murdochia for the week beginning Monday the 25th of July 2011 with me, Andy Zaltzman, in the journalistic Nagasaki that is whopping London, and in New York City, the city of 4 million wombs at an average of approximately half a womb per person. It's the man who is single-handedly dragging that average down. It's John Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. It is hot here, Andy.
Brilliant.
How hot? How about 100 degrees hot? That is literally too warm, Andy. There is an ideal temperature for human comfort, and I think we here in New York are currently at least 20 degrees above it. Let me demonstrate exactly how hot it is, Andy. There is a hole that opened up last night in the road on 26th Street. Now, that's near where I am now, and the pavement was literally melting and sinking into the hole. It was like a bad Jerry Bruckheimer movie. In fact, actually, let me take that back, Andy. It was like an amazing Jerry Bruckheimer movie. Not only could you fry an egg on the road outside, you could poach an egg just by holding it in the air. In fact, the weather forecaster this morning was just a man standing in front of a map in his underpants, sweating through his shirt, holding a miniature fan to his face, sighing and muttering, "Holy shit!" It's like the sun here, Andy. He's trying to send a message to Earth, that message being, let's not argue about who the big dog of this solar system is, because anytime I want to, I can mess your shit up. You do not want to enter into a dick-swinging contest with me. I'm a massive perfect circle of hot plasma and magnetic fields. I'm 109 times bigger than you, and I'm 1,000 times better than you. I'm solar, son! You don't want any piece of this, so why don't you back the f*** up before you get smacked the f*** up. Oh, what's that? What's that? You're running away into night time? Don't worry, I'll be right here when you wake up in the morning, punk. I can burn you all day. You think factor 70 can protect you from what I got? I got a tube of sun cream right here on my middle finger. It's called factor go f*** yourself. That, Andrew, yep, is the message that I think is being effectively and articulately sent today.
I see. Right. Did you think this is possibly some kind of payback for you, John, for the last 2 weeks been banging on about these astronauts and how great space is, yeah, and the sun's...
It could be.
The sun saw, what about me? What about me, yeah, John Oliver? Who is the big one in space? It's not that guy who nearly landed on the moon but couldn't even be asked to get out of his rocket when he got there. So this is Bugle 162. 162, of course, what the Queen says when she's drunk too much at the annual Royal Super Bowl party and finds herself in the cubicle next to a chundering Duchess of Scranthorpe in the toilets at Balmoral. 162. Dangerous rules on their drinking game, John, for the Royal Super Bowl party. They have to neck a shot of tequila every time anyone falls onto the ground. And also, that means 162 Bugles, John. That's one Bugle for every regular season MLB game.
Wow.
And to commemorate this, we will both be spitting on the floor every 5 seconds throughout. So, Chris, you're going to have to edit those out for us. This is for the week beginning Monday, the 25th of July, 2011, which means it is 102 years, John, since Louis Blériot became the first man to fly across the English Channel in an aeroplane. Bloody immigrant, coming over here, landing his plane. Go home, Blériot! Oh, you did. Good. But then come back and set up some aeroplane factories and flight training schools in Britain, thus boosting the British economy and helping the development of the RAF that ultimately saved us from being eaten alive by the Nazis. Bloody immigrant. Also, the 90th anniversary of the first transatlantic two-way radio broadcast, the spiritual forerunner of the Bugle. On this day in 91st and 1920, it was possibly a bit more grown up than this. I don't know.
You don't know that for sure.
Yeah. Probably people just swearing about the sun in those days, I'd imagine. I don't know if they'd develop the bleep. As always, a section of the Bugle is going straight in the bin this week, a psychology diet section. The best meals and snacks to help you find the right mental state for you. We tell you the best food to eat to make yourself feel determined to fulfil your lifelong ambition. And that is a feta cheese and rabbit meat chimichanga. Two of these every day for 2 years could help you finally take the plunge and become the monster truck driver, black ops mercenary, supermarket checkout assistant or artistic director of the Chinese state circus that you've always dreamed of being. And also how a baked courgette pasty can you make you feel less irritated about the famine in Somalia, and why stuffing your face with a kilogram of still-warm hedgehog carpaccio can help you better understand your relationship with your parents. All in the psychology diet section.
Top story this week, Addicted to Hack Part 3. Andy, it's hard for any franchise to withstand a third instalment without just getting sad. The third Godfather movie wasn't great, the third Back to the Future seemed a bit desperate, and the third Love Guru movie's going to hypothetically bring down the medium of cinema. And the same is true.
Well, what's going to build it up in the meantime?
the second one. The same is true with this third week of News of the World Revelations, which started 2 weeks ago as shocking, became exciting, and is now just looking depressing. The circus even had its own clown, attempting to entertain the crowd with some tired, misplaced slapstick, when someone from the public gallery attempted to push a shaving cream pie into Rupert Murdoch's face. I'm not saying, Andy, that Rupert Murdoch's face does not look better with a shaving cream pie in it. It complements it perfectly. But there's a time and a place for doing that, and it was emphatically neither then nor there. You just don't want to find yourself with any misplaced sympathy for Rupert Murdoch. And when you see an 80-year-old man looking frightened, your heart can mistakenly go out to him. Hello? Is this thing still on? I can't work out why this microphone is still working, Andy. Hello? Is anybody listening to this? How are Andy and I still doing this 3 weeks on? Hello? Should this not have been stopped by now? This doesn't make any sense. Hello? Hello?
So I can take up busking, John. It's fine.
I've got something to confess.
What's that?
I've not been publishing it the last couple of weeks.
I understand, Chris. That's just protecting your back and kind of protecting mine and Andy's back for us as well.
So, Murdoch sadly can't be with us on this week's Bugle due to, we've got a compulsory retirement age on this show of 79, so we've decided he's too old. But he was assaulted by a protester wielding, as he said, some shaving foam on a paper plate. And incidentally, I was alerted to this fact on Twitter that the guy who did this was following the Bugle Twitter feed. And
oh, no.
I think he was about to write "F*** you, Chris" in shaving foam on Murdoch's face. But, of course, custard pie throwing has a long and proud tradition as a means of protest in Britain. Julius Caesar was custard pied on his first invasion in 55 BC. Got so annoyed by it that he came back the next year. William the Conqueror copped a foamy one in the face at the Battle of Hastings. But tactically that was an error on the part of King Harold. He should have probably sent in some infantry armed with something a bit more dangerous than custard pies, and inevitably in return he took a pointy one to the eye. And all this was edited out of the Bayeux Tapestry, of course. But the problem was, as you say, it looked like a man attacking a rambling old pensioner. Not, as he probably intended, striking a blow for the humble everyman against one of the most powerful men in the world who exerts control over vast swathes of what the planet thinks. And the problem is, John, it would have been fine had he gone the whole hog and not 5% of the hog and dressed as a clown and used a fully fledged custard pie, possibly even a high-class Portuguese custard tart.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Because then, you know, that gives it a nice little culinary angle, and we love that in this country. But this is the problem, it wasn't clownish enough. It just looked a little bit stroppy. Bit of shaving foam on a plate, a News International spokesman has brushed off the incident as, quotes, an overexcited autograph hunter who has always admired Mr. Murdoch for not having a beard, wanting to have his shaving foam signed.
Rupert Murdoch set the tone at the start of the day by interrupting his son to say, "This is the most humble day of my life." Now, for a start, that's clearly relative, and I can't... Hello? Hello. I can't help thinking that he was using a word he'd heard rather than referencing an adjective that he'd actually ever emotionally experienced. Hello. Hello. Although it did turn out that that statement was writing checks that his conscience refused to cash, as it paved the way for a day of Murdoch denying any personal responsibility, steadfastly refusing to resign, and if there was any remaining question about how seriously he was taking the panel's questions, he even at one point nodded off to sleep. And that is a pretty big f*** you to the investigation, Andy. As a panel, you lose your credibility a little bit when the person whose feet you are supposed to be holding to the fire starts to snore.
Yeah, but, I mean, you say holding their feet to the fire. As grillings go, this wasn't the most sausagey of barbecues, was it? Certainly not quite as toasty as what Joan of Arc had to deal with, what most people believe were much less serious allegations.
That is a fair point. But, you know, the Nuremberg trials would have been critically undermined if Martin Bormann and Hermann Göring had nodded off onto each other's shoulders before waking up with a start and saying, I'm sorry, what was that? Oh, not guilty. Yeah, whatever. Thank you. Can you actually keep it down a bit? Marty and I are trying to line up a power snooze.
But it wasn't that impressive on the part of British democracy, and essentially,
no.
What happened was that the structure of the questioning of the House of Commons quiz broke down, as most quizzes do, into a missing words round, some educated guesswork, a what happened next round, and an extremely large amount of charades. And I was hoping at the end they'd just announce a winner and a loser, with the winner being given full control of Sky TV and the loser going to jail. But that didn't happen, and as it was, everyone just shuffled off and said, well, that's been done for now. There we go. So there it was. So Rebecca Brooks.
Hello. Hello. I can't, Andy. This microphone's working. There's some problem here.
Rebecca Brooks, essentially during her testimony, went rope-a-dope. She kept pretty stum, rumbled in the bungle. Essentially, she claimed she was only responsible for the quick crosswords and the agony aunt column during her time as editor of the News of the World. And I think the problem was, John, that the panel of MPs looked her in the eye, and as you should know from anyone with hair like that, you have to look at them through a mirror. That's basic Greek mythology. And there have been allegations today that James Murdoch might have got some of his answers wrong. He said that he was not aware of an email suggesting that hacking went wider than an obviously too convenient single rogue reporter. Two former News of the World bigwigs said that what he actually meant to say was that he was aware of that email. Murdoch says, no, I'm sticking with my original answer, so I guess we'll just have to wait and see. The truth, John, has taken an absolute codload of battering over the last few weeks. See, come to think of it, it's taken a bit of a battering over the last 100,000 years, so it should be used to it. Toughen up, truth, and stop complaining. But I just don't know what's true and what's not anymore, John. Just last night, my wife made me a spicy squid salad for my dinner, and I said, is that really squid, or is that bits of Buzz Aldrin's leg? I just don't know anymore.
The latter half of the week saw the attention turn to the seemingly non-platonic, grubby relationship between News of the World and high-level British politicians.
That is so far from platonic. I mean, I'm not saying it's romantic, John. I think it goes the other side of romantic, into essentially the relationship between a businessman and a prostitute down the back alley of a seedy nightclub.
Hey, they're getting paid, Andy. They're getting paid. It's a living. Prime Minister David Cameron was dragged back from his trip to Africa after just 2 days. And it must have been very difficult for him to explain to his children why he was coming back empty-handed. Sorry, but Daddy didn't have time to get you any souvenirs because he's embroiled in a potentially career-ending ethics scandal. But look, I did bring you back this pen. Look, it's got Daddy's lawyer's legal firm written on the side of it, and you can pretend it's a plane. I'm guessing that he was planning, Andy, on bringing them a stuffed toy lion back, or, knowing his background and if he'd listened to his genetic instincts, a stuffed actual lion. The scene in the House of Commons during the questioning was pretty energetic. I haven't heard so much jeering and screaming since one of those crazy daytime talk shows where the host stands in front of three angry-looking people sitting on the stage and reveals the results of a paternity test. And to be fair, Cameron did his best attempt at humility. Unfortunately, his best is absolutely pathetic. He said his hiring of Andy Coulson as his press secretary, who had just resigned in disgrace from News of the World, in the wake of the first wave of phone hacking revelations, he said, with 2020 hindsight and all that has followed, I would not have offered him the job. But hold on. The phone hacking scandal was the reason he resigned in the first place. You already knew that. That's not 2020 hindsight. That's 2020 sight. That's perfect, unimpaired vision with which to make an informed decision.
I thought, are you banging your hand on the desk there, John? That's what Murdoch was doing in the questioning on Tuesday.
He's
got into you, John.
Oh, God.
He's bringing you down. But he did admit, it's 2020 hindsight, that's all he said. The problem is, John, not only was the evidence of Coulson having resigned as part of the phone hacking scandal already there, but also a number of senior figures in government, including Nick Clegg, were suggesting to him that it might be a bad idea. So when he says with hindsight, what he actually means is with other people's foresight, which he chose to ignore. He also said some amazing things. He said, talking about the police angle of this scandal, which is continuing to envelop the Metropolitan Police, he said there are too few and arguably too similar candidates for the top police jobs. He then turned around, took a look at the social makeup of his Deputy Prime Minister, his Chancellor of the Exchequer, and the rest of his cabinet sitting next to him on the front bench, and said, "Yup, I realise that might have sounded a bit odd coming out of my mouth." He also said that in the course of their investigations into this, the police should, quote, arrest whoever they choose, which, you know, they had a mixed record with that in the 1970s, as I recall. And the police in Bahrain seem to keep getting criticised when they do that. Let's have some consistency, Mr Cameron. But overall, did you watch the House of Commons?
I did.
It was pretty depressing, John. It showed the British Parliament had its infantile braying worst. MPs roaring and bleating with triumphalism. And then a kind of bizarre mix of MPs both saying this very, very important issue should not be used for petty political point scoring, and MPs nakedly trying to score petty political points. It was classic democracy. I have a message from the Bugle to the MPs of this country. Uh-huh. Grow the f*** up. Our forefathers fought two world wars so you could sit in Parliament talking in English, not in A, German, or B, animal noises, which is what most of you seem to choose to use. In fact, I think it probably would be better if you used A instead of B. And John Bercow, the Speaker, tried to establish order in the Parliament, and he said this to him, he said, "This is the mother of parliaments." And I think it might be time, if that's the case, to pop the old dear in a nursing home and just do the decent thing for everyone.
Libya update now. And what do you remember, Libya, Andy? It's the black sheep war that no one likes to talk about. You know, whenever it's even brought up, politicians tend to roll their eyes or kick each other under the table and try and change the subject. And it is amazing just how much our attention span for wars has shrunk. We started bombing Libya just 3 months ago, literally bombing them, dropping bombs onto their country from our planes. How have we got bored by it so quickly? I guess the pace of life now has increased so much that we just demand quicker results. The Second World War lasted 6 years. If we felt then like we do now, we'd have stopped paying attention to it by the spring of 1940. It'd still be going on now for all we cared.
Do you know the shortest war in history, John? How long would you think that was, the shortest ever recorded war?
I think I know this. Wasn't it like 15 minutes?
It was 38 minutes.
Oh,
the
yeah.
The war between Britain and Zanzibar in the 1890s. Yeah. A 38-minute war.
What was the result of that? Zanzibar won and conquered us for 45 minutes.
It was an away win. Away win for Britain.
That's embarrassing for Zanzibar.
Well, it was a two-leg war as well, so they really struggled for their much weakened team in the second leg.
I think the only way that people were going to be satisfied by this was if Gaddafi had come out and surrendered straight away with his own head on a spike. Anything short of that is perceived as a total disaster. And France this week have been looking for a way out of this civil war, and strange that the French have lost their appetite for a fight, Andy. If their appetite for war was only half their appetite for soft cheese, they could have been a global superpower at some point in history.
I think their plan, though, the French plan, is just to feed Colonel Gaddafi with seed, just consistently put a special thing around his neck until he just kind of carks it and becomes extremely tasty.
France's foreign minister has been trying to negotiate an agreement with the rebels where Gaddafi is allowed to stay in the country as long as he relinquishes power. The rebels, in turn, have countered that offer by saying that he can stay in the country, but only if he's buried 6 feet underground. So at least the two sides are starting to negotiate, Andy. That is the first step.
And the rebel leaders have been looking to the international community for support, and the international community has basically responded, "Oh, are you lot still alive? Well, this is going much better than it might have done." And so that's kind of depressing, isn't it? Well, basically, the international community is now trying to persuade Gaddafi that he can step down from political life because, quotes, you've earned the right to enjoy your retirement. And he doesn't seem to be biting, John. He doesn't seem to be biting.
Stupid argument news now! And Andy, given all the legitimate points of disagreement and discussion around the world at the moment, there are some absolutely ludicrous spats going on. In Nepal, there is a big argument going on between the Nepalese and the Chinese governments. And again, that in itself is no surprise. They do have plenty to argue about. The surprising thing is that this time it's over the exact height of Mount Everest. Nepal has ordered a new study of the mountain to end the apparent confusion over its exact height. The Chinese have argued that it should be measured by its rock height. Nepal said it should be measured by its snow height, which is 4 metres higher. So the entire argument is over 4 metres, Andy. 4 metres.
What
does the French say? Quatre metre. Quatre metre. Happy week after Bastille Day, Andy. I know there's probably still celebrations going on.
Well, we used to wars about silly things, John, and I really hope this escalates into a full military conflict between China and Nepal. Because this has to be resolved one way or the other. And by which I mean the other, which is war. I mean, there've been wars about stupid things. Nothing stupider than the whole pretend blood, real blood shtick that seems to have fired quite a lot of wars over the years. But, so China's official policy on this is rock, snow, no. And I have to say, I'm right with the Chinese on this, John, because you take the snow away from the rock, still a pretty sizable mega beast of a mountain, John, super mountain Mount Everest. Real credit to the tectonic plates of India and Asia smashing into each other all those weeks ago. Quite a lot of weeks. Billions of weeks. But you take the rock away from the snow, John, what have you got? Big pile of snow. That is clearly not as impressive, John. Clearly not as impressive.
When you put it like that, it does make sense, Andy. Yeah. I don't want to come over all psychoanalytical here, though, Andy, but this is classic displacement aggression. This is like a married couple getting into a huge fight over who finished the raspberry jam. That's not an argument about the jam at all. Neither of them really give a shit about the jam. It's about the fact that they f***ing hate each other. The same is true here. This is not about the height of the mountain. It's about each side trying to tell the other to go f*** itself.
The current generally accepted height is 8,848 metres, 29,029 feet.
And pretty tall.
Yeah, incidentally, if you do text 08848-29029 from your mobile, you get eaten by a Yeti. It's a very interesting coincidence. America, of course, claims that it is 8,850 metres. Typical America. Everything always has to be bigger. And the Nepalese government is now beginning a 2-year task to measure the height of Mount Everest. Now,
let
me save them some time. I've got an atlas here, and here we are. Here's the Himalaya page. Himalaya, not the first time someone round Wapping has said Himalaya in the last few days. Anyway, Mount Everest, 8,848 metres. There you go. Give or take. It doesn't matter. It's not going to make any difference. There aren't going to be many mountaineers eagerly waiting for their expedition of a lifetime to take on the mythical and often deadly roof of the world who are going to say, what? It's only 8,846 metres. Oh, it's barely worth it. Let's sack it off and swim to the bottom of the ocean instead. And there aren't...
Wrong, Andy. You are wrong about that. This is 2 years very well spent. I don't care how much it costs. Firstly, as we all know, Nepal is absolutely loaded. They're rolling in money over there, Andy. And secondly, money is no object when it comes to finding out about whether or not Mount Everest is 4 metres higher than we think it is. I personally can't sleep at night without knowing the answer one way or the other.
I guess I do have to, for the sake of any climbers going up there who might be surprised by a little bit extra at the top, who are going to get to the top and say, I've done it. I've checked my altimeter. 8,848 metres above sea level. I'm on top of the highest... What the f***? There's still 3 metres to go. Oh, f*** it. I'm out of here. There's no way a human being can go that high. No f***ing way.
Stupid building update now, and it's not just stupid buildings this week, Andy. There is something possibly even stupidier now in the United Arab Emirates. A sheik there. Hamad bil Hamdan.
A sheik, John, did you say?
A sheik.
Is that a particularly well-dressed sheik?
Sheik. I say sheik.
Oh,
it's too hot here, Andy. It's too hot. A sheik there. Hamad bil Hamdan Al Nahyan, who is worth a reported $22.5 billion, has done something truly ridiculous. Now, first, let me give you a little background on this man. He's known as the Rainbow Sheik, partly because he apparently owns more than 200 cars, including seven Mercedes 500 SELs, painted in all the different colours of the rainbow, and all of which, and this is where it gets amazing, are housed in his own custom-built pyramid. So... That already is evidence of a demonstrably gargantuan ego. And also, does that not show how far humanity as a species has come? Pyramids were once solemn tombs, designed as resting places for important figures to assist their soul's passage to heaven. This guy has built one so he can park his stupid f***ing cars in it. So, you can already tell exactly how respectful he is of the concept of money. So, what's he done? Well... Among these things, he also happens to own a private island called Al Futasi, across the water from the city of Abu Dhabi. But that wasn't enough, Andy, obviously. No, because he has now carved his name into the sand there, 2 miles wide, so massively that his name is now visible from space. The name Hamad has been spelt out in letters sometimes a kilometre tall. That is incredible.
He's a big name. He's a big name. I think the reason he's done it, John, is to encourage himself when he is riding his 40-metre-high bicycle across it in the Tour de Abu Dhabi. There's a joke for cycling fans. You like that one, didn't you, Chris? You like that.
Boom!
Boom!
It's said that sports cars are often men compensating for having a small penis. And if that's true, what does that say about Hamad, who has 200 sports cars and has carved his name into his own private island?
Does that suggest that he's got 200 small penises?
That's exactly what it suggests. The first two letters have even been flooded with water, so this means he can technically go swimming inside his own name. Even more than that, he can technically drive a jet ski around the first letter of his name. And I wonder if, when he's doing that, Andy, there's a moment where he stops, turns off the jet ski, and floats around, bobbing in silence, and thinks to himself, I've done very well. Donald Trump is also apparently considering firing all of his staff for not suggesting that he do exactly what happened. He may now pay to have Trump written over the top of the sheikh's name and have it written in gold. But the best way to get fired as one of this sheikh's employees, when given instructions to complete this job, was instead of writing Hamad, writing douche in the sand instead. And then having that conversation, it's like, oh, I'm sorry, sir, I thought you said douche. No, I said, definitely said I wanted my name in there. Oh, I thought your name was douche. No! My name is Hamad! Wow. I wonder why I was so sure that your name was douche. I guess it was something to do with what you were asking me to do. That made me absolutely certain that your actual name was douche. Oh, do you know what? I'm sure we can make the adjustments for you and get you exactly the name that you wanted there, Mr. Douche. I mean Hamad. I mean douche.
Well, there you go. That's good, nice. That's a second story about people insulting their bosses and getting fired. In other stupid buildings news, it has turned out that the world's biggest ever McDonald's restaurant is going to be built, wait for it, in the Olympic Park in London. The home,
yes!
The spiritual home of sports,
yes!
And athleticism is also going to be the spiritual home of big fat f***ers. Now, there's a possible misunderstanding about what the supposed Olympic legacy is supposed to be for London 2012. Is it supposed to be an active youth participating in sport and maintaining healthy lifestyles? Or a youth addicted to clogging their own arteries and eating polystyrene? Or whatever McDonald's make their food out of these days. What was I supposed to open the box? My mistake.
But we should be proud, Andy. Now, we should not be feeling inferior with the huge buildings going up around Saudi Arabia, because we're getting back into the stupid building race now. This may have been our Sputnik moment. This new McDonald's, as you say, is going to be in London's Olympic Park. It's 3,000 square metre restaurants. It stretches over two floors and is equivalent to half the length of an American football field and has 1,500 seats. It's what Christopher Wren would have designed, Andy, if he'd been alive today, because what was St Paul's except a prototype for a low-end burger chain? And you like that Abu Dhabi? The world's largest. Do we need to spell out F*** you in 500-foot letters and paint it on the side of the cliffs of Dover?
1,500 people are going to be able to eat simultaneously in this restaurant to eat the world's favourite physical white noise all together. 1,500 people at once, John, are going to be able to take one look at the Olympic slogan, Kittius, Altius, Fortius, faster, higher, stronger, and say, 0-3! And the Olympics will nod sagely and quietly change its slogan to slower, fatter, spottier.
This McDonald's is going to beat, is going to destroy the current largest McDonald's, which is, guess where? That's right, Orlando, Florida. And they're hoping to serve 1.75 million meals during the Olympic Games. 2,000 workers will be chosen from the chain's top-selling franchises all over the world. So it's going to be an all-star team, Andy, of people working minimum-wage jobs without benefits. And I don't think as well, don't be mistaken to think that they're going to stop there, because this is apparently going to be just one of four restaurants that they are building in the Olympic area. So that's nice, isn't it? That's nice. You've got options, choice. And as you say, what better way to celebrate the gathering of athletes in the peak of the human physical condition than by eating chemically flavoured poison in the form of pseudo-meat?
Testify!
The fast food outlet's UK chief executive, Jill McDonald, has called the announcement of the building of this gigantic McDonald's hugely exciting. And a spokesman for the rest of humanity issued a press release calling it gut-churningly depressing.
Buglers, I have some extremely distressing news. The next instalment of the Congressman's Penis will not be happening this week.
Oh, that's great, Andy.
What, mate?
That's tremendous.
What, mate? What,
sorry?
What?
What's that?
What, mate?
I must have been thinking of something
what,
else.
What, mate?
But, Andy, is there... just so I know,
yep,
mentally, to prepare myself... Do you know yet how many instalments it's going to take, or are we approaching closure on this?
Well, what I would say to you, John, is when God sat down to write the Book of Genesis, did he know quite how far the Bible would spiral out of control?
Okay, all right, I'll consider that question answered.
I thought they were readings from an already written book, though.
What, the Bible? Oh, well, yeah, sorry, yeah. Yeah, sorry, no, it's, yeah, well, we're negotiating with Grisham's legal team.
Yeah,
right. Yep. It does seem to be just some feedback suggesting that not everyone wants the next episode of The Congressman's Penis, but, you know.
I don't think anyone minds the next episode if it's the last episode,
really?
Andy.
Okay. That's a big if. That is a big if.
That's the concern, is the size of the if.
Yep. And don't forget, there's almost certainly going to be a sequel. The President's Penis.
Oh, I thought you could say the congressman's balls.
Your emails now, and this is the one you've been waiting for or hoping would never happen for weeks. It's the Philosophy Puns email from Asaf Bittner, writing from Ra'anana in Israel. That's a silly name. Let's just say Israel. Anyway, I probably should know that. These places are all very close to my heart. Anyway,
this could be one of your low points as a Jew, this, Andy. That last 15 seconds couldn't have been worse if you were literally chewing on bacon as you were mispronouncing it.
What do you mean, if? Dear John, Chris and Andy, I've recently begun my university studies majoring in philosophy. At first, I thought it was quite an interesting subject and would lead to positive consequences, not financially, but perhaps otherwise. However, a few days ago, I had a conversation with my friend, Guy, that showed me the dangers of combining philosophy studies with listening to the Bugle. It was morning when Guy came to visit me at my house. We greeted each other and sat down to talk. So how are you doing? You look like you have a lot on your plate, old friend. Plato, old friend.
Mm-hmm.
I said, personally, I'm doing great. I'm a Leibniz, good to be alive. That's Leibniz, Gottfried Leibniz. I'm a Leibniz, good to be alive.
Yeah, I got it.
Oh, I have a humongous burden, he replied. Hume, bingo. I have to move out of my apartment in 2 days. Say, could you help me move some of my things? I'll let you use the trolley. You mean Descartes? Yes, exactly. So you can be there tomorrow? I'm terribly sorry, my friends, but I can't. Tomorrow I'll be busy helping my Jewish neighbour Jennifer with a work project of hers, I said. What, you're going to manufacture another electronic hairpiece that shouts vulgar comments at its wearer, he asked. That's right. I'm going to make a Ludwig Wittgenstein. Come on. Standing ovation. Ludwig Wittgenstein. Did you not get it, John? Like the vulgar electronic...
I got it right between the eyes.
Yeah. Oh, well, I like Jennifer. She's quite a neat gal, don't you think? Indeed, I replied. Neat she is. Suddenly, I received a phone call from my boss. He said that the paperwork I'd filed was very disorganised and he couldn't understand my handwriting. OK, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to confuse you, sir. Confuse you, sir. When I hung up, Guy asked, what was that about? That new business venture you were telling me about, the spa for rodents that like using human footwear. Yep. It'll be a place that puts its focus on sock rat ease.
Yikes.
There we go. Ooh. How's your brother doing with his vineyard, Guy asked. Are his wines any good? Well, his Pinot's a little dry. His Pinot's a little dry for me. I need to practice this. His Spinoza's a little dry for me. Anyway, but otherwise, he's a great selection. So that's a nice bracelet you have. Where's it from? Oh, it's not actually a bracelet. It's a necklace for people with extremely thin necks. Yeah, that piece of jewellery isn't supposed to be worn on a wrist at all. Oh, come on! This is going downhill. Just as we were about to finish, Guy mentioned the recent heatwave in France. I heard that the farmers in the countryside have resorted to shoving snow up their hens' arses in order to cool them off. No doubt about it. Francis Bacon. As you can see, Asaph concludes, my situation is dire. Before my mind is completely consumed by the darkness of engulfing bullshit, I would like to leave you with one loving message from the bottom of my heart. F*** you, Chris.
You're joking, is that the end?
That's the end. Sarcastically yours, Asaph Bittner. Originally from Boston, Massachusetts, John. So he's one of yours, not one of mine.
Asaph, you know, I can only hope that brings people of the Middle East together, Israelis and Palestinians, either for or against those puns. Either way, I hope it can act as a lightning rod.
Thanks, Asaph. John has suffered enough.
Oh, Andy. That is the equivalent of punching a boxer in the head when he's already down and the fight's been over.
So, there you go, Buglers. What a treat. Stroke, I'm terribly sorry. Delete as applicable. There you go. That's it for this week's Bugle.
That is it.
That is it.
That is it.
Yep. We may be back next week. If not...
We keep saying that, Andy. Yep. We keep saying that and we keep coming back. Let's see.
We might go for
a
while.
You know where we are. Come and get us.
Don't come and get us.
Yeah, please leave us alone. Please continue to leave us alone.
Bye-bye, Buglers.
Bye, Buglers.
And if
we're not, is still on.
If we're not in next week, can I just plug my Edinburgh show now? Because I was going to do it next week.
Sure, you might as well.
Yeah, 4:25 at the stands every day. 5th of August to the 28th. Don't miss it. It's going to be awesome. Literally awesome. Bye-bye.
Bye!